From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, California, this is Indie Media On Air on Pacifica Radio. I'm Chris Burnett. My guest today is Matt Callahan, author of The Explosion of Deferred Dreams, Musical Renaissance and Social Revolution in San Francisco, 1965 to 1975, published by PM Press. Matt is a musician, author, songwriter, activist, and a co-founder of the artist collective Commotion International in San Francisco. I'm very excited to have Matt in studio to talk about this new book. I grew up as a kind of anarcho-punk into the working class bands coming out of the UK, but I didn't fully appreciate how interwoven the music scene and politics were in the 60s and how truly radical it really was. While I have always been obsessed about the politics of the 60s and 70s and have read countless memoirs, it was hard for me to appreciate the context that both music and politics flourished in. That is until you read a book like Matt's. And of course, it's a story about San Francisco as well. I think reading one of the blurbs inside the book may help highlight its significance. This one was written by Pat Thomas. Matt Callahan was a red diaper baby lucky to be attending a San Francisco high school during the Summer of Love. He takes a studied approach, but with the eye of a revolutionary, describing the socio-political landscape that led to the explosion of popular music, rock, jazz, folk, R&B, coupled with the birth of several diverse radical movements during the golden 1965 to 1975 age of the Bay Area. Callahan comes at it from every angle imaginable. Black power, anti-Vietnam War, the media, the new left, feminism, sexual revolution, with the voice of authority backed up by interviews with those who lived it. And with that, Matt Callahan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's great to have you. I'd like to set the stage for what happens in San Francisco in the 60s. So let's talk about how the political and cultural forces are merging. For example, what does the left look like in the Bay Area in the 50s, and what's going on with the beatniks?
Well, two vital components of a obviously more complicated situation were that on the one side you had a movement a labor movement that was very strong relative to other cities, you might say represented by the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union. This union was not only strong in the sense of economic power vis-a-vis the ship owners or something like that, but was strong in different social ways. It was integrated. It had, from the very beginning, brought black workers into not only the union but into the leadership of the union. And its social influence was much broader than, let's say, a conventional trade union that was only interested in wages, hours, and working conditions. Because partly the life of San Francisco and the Bay Area did center around the port and maritime trade. Many, many jobs and other occupations were connected to it. But more than that, the ILWU and the waterfront had been a haven for blacklisted people, and including, you know, blacklisted filmmakers or people involved with the film industry and other places in the United States could come there and get work. So it had that kind of social strength and importance. And at the same time, you had a new generation of young people, many of whom were actually the descendants of people who had been in the labor movement before the World War II and so on, who were then active in the free speech movement and even earlier with the you might say the watershed moment of the demonstration against the House Un-American Activities Committee that took place in 1960 in San Francisco, which really in many ways is a symbolic end to the McCarthy era prior to that. And this was something that, again, if you had been living in San Francisco at the time, whether you were political or not, whether you were a musician or not, you would certainly have been aware of and influenced and affected by. Mm. So in terms of the social milieu and the political situation within which the Beats actually evolved and developed. That was already there, and in I would take it even a step further to say that venues such as the Hungry Eye or other places that cultivated quote bohemian subculture slash politically aware comedy, or in some ways these things were all interacting, because first of all San Francisco is small, and the neighborhoods of the areas where these venues were a few blocks of the city. So people were going back and forth between a jazz workshop and the Hungry Eye and Cafe Trieste and City Lights and so on and so forth. And the influence of the Beats, therefore, was very direct. You know what I'm saying? So when City Lights was raided by the cops for obscenity on the Howl poem being the reason, the motivation, and the trial beginning in 1957, the notoriety, the attraction of the media to San Francisco, and what was happening there, obviously, was one of the compounding effects in this whole milieu. And in that sense, you also had, I think, something that became a kind of a hallmark of the subsequent period, which is that there was really no way to practically or let's say, intellectually, to separate politics from art, because everything seemed to be, whether or not it was overtly political or overtly revolutionary or against the Vietnam War or for the civil rights movement or whatever, whatever the content of the art, it was being expressed or performed in this milieu. Mm.
And of course, there's this, you talk about a lot of this, examples of this. You talk about the importance of China books. Mm-hmm. You talk about dance as an art form, mm-hmm. which I knew, had no idea about, and that sort of transformative moment in dance. And of course, about folk and jazz. And how does this, sort of set the stage for what's coming?
Well, it sets the stage in at least a couple of ways, perhaps more, but off the top of my head. I mean, for one thing, the fact that San Francisco was a port was certainly not unique. I mean, Los Angeles was a port, Seattle's a port, and so on. But there's a combination of elements that really did take root and flourished in San Francisco very early on, when San Francisco was the city on the West Coast. We're talking about the early 19th century, shortly after the Gold Rush. And this, of course, as I talk about in the first chapter of the book, has to do with Isadora Duncan on the one hand and the development of modern dance, and on the other hand, the labor movement itself. Okay. And these two things, as I say in the book, had they just been sort of anomalies that just kind of went away, flared up in 1910 or 1920 and it disappeared, that would be one thing, but they didn't. They continued pretty much unabated right through World War II, and continued to influence not only the art of modern dance or music, the avant-garde musicians that like John Cage and Lou Harrison and other people who collaborated with dancers and provided a lot of the nourishment, the musical background to that. But at the same time, it encouraged venues and it encouraged the interplay between various art forms that were in some senses outside of the industrial norms.
Right.
Outside, not only geographically, as New York and L.A. were far away from San Francisco, but you might say spiritually or intellectually or in terms of people's attitudes. And this encouraged a kind of freedom of expression, a certain spirit of experiment and so on, which certainly continued into the 60s.
Mm-hmm. You write that prior to World War II, there were no teenagers, and that the name rock and roll was given to a musical form already named rhythm and blues, which itself had replaced an earlier name, race music, and what was once labeled hillbilly music became country and western. Tell me more about these labels and their transformation. Was this just a capitalist branding strategy? What was going on?
Well, initially, I think there was, you could say, a capitalist branding strategy that goes all the way back to the origins of recorded music and how the music industry developed with the sale of Victrolas and radios, back in the early 20th century, and the fact that they were very early on concerned with demographics and, different ethnic and generational groups, rural versus urban and so on. But fundamentally, and this is an extremely important part of the story. It was racism, that white supremacy that was being sold by the music industry. And this was very deliberate. This was not, oh, that just happens to be the mood of the time and people are racist, so we're giving them what they want. This was actually orchestrated and deliberately disseminated. And it goes back to the mid 19th century with the minstrel show, and the that's a whole history in itself. But by the time you get to the modern music industry, which has to do with recording and goes beyond just publishing sheet music and so on, but actually selling the recordings of people playing music, they had to devise means of perpetuating this kind of division between white and black and so on. And so the naming, you know, the naming of a brand might as well have been white music versus black music. But of course they weren't going to say that. And not only were they not going to say it, as Jerry Wexler, who coined the term rhythm and blues, says himself, and I quote him in the book, he and his team at Billboard magazine, who were naming these charts, found, and this is to quote him, found the term race inappropriate in 1949. Now, what does that mean? That means that by 1949, and particularly after World War II, the growth of the civil rights movement and the demand to integrate the armed forces and to start breaking down these old Jim Crow laws had reached a crescendo, and it was obviously going to go even further shortly thereafter. So what he means by inappropriate, He's really saying it was blatant racism, and we couldn't get away with that anymore. So he came up with rhythm and blues, and you know, that's just one example. I mean, the fact is that in purely musical terms, if you go back and listen to the music that was recorded in the 20s and 30s, a lot of it's indistinguishable. It's hard to tell who's singing, whether it's white or black or whatever. It's just rural Southern music, and in many cases, the influences are you know, absolutely porous. You know, they're going back and forth. People are listening to each other, whether it be in churches or you know, in other situations where music could be shared. And that's actually characteristic of you might say American music. It's true in other countries too that have large immigrant populations. There's going to be a cross-pollinization, and there always was. In spite of the racism, in spite of slavery, and in spite of all the oppressions that were involved in this, the interpenetration of music was constant and continuous. But the music industry needed to develop its markets, and it needed to serve a certain social function, which was, in fact, the perpetuation of white supremacy.
And you articulate that very well in the book. And, you know, for me, hearing the origins, you know, I kind of knew, but, you know, when you actually read this history, it's fascinating. You know, it's important to understand both from, you know, if somebody's interested in music, but politically as well. Like, you know, where does this come from and why? And of course, it makes sense, right? If you think about cross-pollinization, it's going to happen, and it always happens. Norman Mailer wrote in 1957 an essay called The White Negro, in which he described the term hip and hipster as a kind of wedding between white and black, in which the quote-unquote Negro brought the cultural dowry, as he said. You write that genuine hipness is to be hip to the fact that the system caused suffering and injustice and had to be overcome by any means necessary. And I'd never heard that before. Was the term hippie a derogatory term that the establishment invented?
Yes. Hip is not hippie. and being hip certainly doesn't lead to being called a hippie. The term hippie was coined actually by Michael Fallon, a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner in 1965. He was writing a story about the opening of the Blue Unicorn Cafe. It was a coffee shop right across, basically in the edges of the Haight-Ashbury district. And it said, New Haven for Beatniks. That was actually the title of the article. New Haven, another term coined by media. New Haven for Beatniks. And then it went in the stories, the so-called hippies and so on and so forth. And from that point on, the term was, you know, picked up, as often happens. You know, I mean, the media just feeds on itself in a sense. Once somebody comes up with a term like yuppie, that just goes over. You know, you can pinpoint who actually first wrote it, but it just disseminates so quickly and so widely that I'd say within a year, it was being used all the time. But it was derogatory. the intention was definitely to mock and ridicule young people who were growing their hair long, wearing colorful clothing, smoking marijuana, and generally dropping out of the system's set of success stories or how you're supposed to achieve maturity or a career or something like that. Anyway, the point is that was definitely its purpose, and the result was that in common parlance, you'd have straight people. Remember, the term straight actually at that time had no reference to sexuality. It was whether it replaced the square from the beatnik era. Straight became the square of the hip era. And straights would usually accompany the derogatory "you hippies" with "get a bath, get a job, take a bath, get a job," and so on. And that was the kind of thing. But and I think people need to understand as well that for a number of years, these symbols or badges of identification made you a target, and it was not by any means peace and love in the sense that the sort of euphoric imagery that people reflecting on it 40 years later would have you believe, because those things were against the system. In other words, people were threatened by the long hair and the loose clothing and the you might even call it the feminization of masculinity, of people caring for each other and all those sorts of ideals. And that being expressed openly, publicly in society and not in some darkened cafe. As I quote one participant in the whole thing at the time saying, the Beats and the previous generation, wore black turtlenecks, berets, sat behind dark shades, in coffee houses. And, we wanted to get out and express ourselves openly and vibrantly with color and with physical movement, collective activity in public. And I think that this is very important. So the derogatory notion, hippie, was designed to mock that.
And, as I said before the interview, my understanding is growing up, basically as a punk and feeling outside the system, immediately when I was reading your book, I'm like, oh, long hair was that kind of statement. And it was in many ways, you were putting it out there and it was dangerous. You were going to get beat up potentially by the straights or whoever. Mm-hmm. And, it was a real moment of understanding that. And I'm like, I felt that too, of course. When do we first hear the term freak? What is its significance?
Oh, well, actually, chronologically and in terms of my memory as well as the memories of the people I interviewed for this, it's about the same time as hippie. 64, 65, in that period, the term head and the term freak became adopted. Head derives from dope head, pothead, whatever, that kind of usage, and freak, the same thing. It's like it was sort of a self put down, if you want to say. I mean, you it's kind of like, okay, they think of us as freaks, so we're going to call ourselves freaks.
Of course.
And I think that the importance of that is that it also, by 1967, people on the street also addressed themselves as brother and sister. That was a very widespread terminological, this became common parlance. So strangers meeting on the street would say brother or sister to each other. And that was, you might say, they were interchangeable terms is what I'm saying. Those were the terms of self-identification as opposed to hippie. I must say, just to be as historically accurate as possible, by 1969, that late in the day, 4 years after the original printing of the term, people were actually accepting it and saying, I'm a hippie, or so-and-so is a hippie. And right. Not proudly or happily, but just kind of like, okay, that's what you call me. That's what I am.
Yeah.
But not in the sense of, wow, isn't it cool? I'm a hippie. It was more like, okay, I'm stuck with this. The media's called it that. And yes, I'm going to these festivals. I'm taking this, I'm smoking marijuana, I'm doing all this stuff, so I guess I am.
Yeah, and in your book you say the freak is declaring one's independence from the white identity constructed by a racist order.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is specifically In relationship to music and musicians in particular. I can't speak generally about, you know, the entire counterculture or anything, but I just know that for particularly for music lovers and people that were involved in making music, the fact that, you know, so much of the influence, not entirely, but to a large extent, did come from African American culture. It came out of this root. And when you're doing it and you're making it and you want to learn how to play better and you're interested in studying it, even if you're not political at all, then it becomes to your attention that the stuff that you've been fed, the Mickey Mouse, the image of, you know, Donna Reed, Bing Crosby, you know, all this kind of white pablum, white mayonnaise music is what you don't like, and what you do like is the masters of this music are people like Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and James Brown. And I mean, you know, there's no denying where that comes from. So when you want to be, quote, hip, and I'm not talking about being a hippie, I'm saying being hip, getting hip would certainly entail understanding who the real masters were and who are the people that are going to teach you how to be cool and how to make good music that speaks from your heart and soul. And that's what I meant in that sense.
In your chapter, Making Music to Change the World, Diversity, Unity, and Liberation, you write, "Most commentators have focused on lyrical content to determine political intent or effect, failing to account for the fact that music itself became politically subversive. Finally, musicians were not alone or even mainly responsible for such challenges to convention. Rather, it was the audiences that gathered to demand it." Can you explain this? Because, you know, you could argue, couldn't you, that this is always a case about an audience. And what was the music itself a form of radicalism?
Okay, well, there are two parts to that question and two parts to the answer. First of all, to go directly to the question of what I say, the audience was the show. The crucial component here is that for a number of years, and beginning in 65, what you had was the ancient rite of the festival. You had a gathering of people who were not there to watch stars perform. They were there to participate in a communal event. The musicians, the band, whoever it was, and it could be, you know, jazz, it could be Indian ragas, it could be klezmer, it could be anything, and it was often a mixture of all those different things. That was simply a force that gathered people together and allowed them to function as a collective or social body. And this is really crucial to understanding because that's what fueled the music. In other words, originally, the music that was being played to these audience wasn't actually particularly innovative. You know, it was old blues and folk music and a mixture of rock tunes and whatnot. When you first went to the Fillmore, it was a real mixed bag. And mixed is the important part because it wasn't all very good. Some of the best music was coming like from Chicago, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, for example, a prime example of what I'm talking about, where they came as a hard Chicago blues band playing music that was very far away from what most of the young people attending these things had heard before. They were exposed to it. They loved it. That ended up bringing, you know, the musicians to live in the Bay Area. And their second album in 1966 is a perfect example. Here's a blues band from Chicago playing an album called East West, which is not blues. It is blues. Blues is definitely a component, but they're doing this Ravi Shankar, John Coltrane-inspired long jams, which was a forerunner of what would come to be very popular in the 60s at the Fillmore and the Avalon Ballrooms. And so it's that kind of stew that was a result of their being exposed to an audience who appreciated what they were doing and them realizing that, wow, this is a totally different situation. We're used to playing in nightclubs that are adults only and serving alcohol. Now we're suddenly in a situation where people are just coming for the music. They love whatever we do. And, you know, they're freaks. They're weird. And that kind of environment affected everyone. And as I quote a couple of the different participants saying, one of the characteristics of the scene early on and then throughout the period that I'm referring to was that the the people did not come for the headliner. They came for the experience. They came to participate in an event. And that's a completely different relationship between artist and performer, performer and audience, audience and music. And this is a very crucial thing, because I think that, you know, if I can jump ahead or perhaps get to the other side of your question, I think one of the really important aspects of why music was subversive in a political or sociological sense was precisely that it was breaking all of the limitations that had been established by the music industry. And in this case, we're talking about everything from the 3-minute song format, which was designed to make, you know, music palatable to radio, or the stylistic format, the segregated white from black and so on and so forth, or told you can't play this because no one in America is going to like it. Well, Ravi Shankar was incredibly popular, and so was a lot of other music. I mean, on freeform radio, which developed at that time, the proof is right there, because you're hearing whole albums played on a regular basis. This went on for several years, with Sun Ra being followed by Moby Grape being followed by, you know, Lothar and the Hand People. I mean, the mixture is so broad that it defies all categorization, and that is exactly the point.
My guest today is Matt Callahan, author of The Explosion of Deferred Dreams: Musical Renaissance and Social Revolution in San Francisco, 1965 to 1975, published by PM Press. So prior to the 60s, of course, there were people like Joe Hill and Woody Guthrie, and no doubt many others whose names we don't know. Mm-hmm. There were clearly radicals singing and fighting for a better world. And in your section on the People's Republic of Music, you talk about music's ancient rivalry with the state. You even quote Plato to make the point, where he said, "The musical modes are never changed without changes to the most important of the city's laws." I'd like to expand on this rivalry between music and the state, or art and the state, and this idea that the sound of music itself was a threat to the state.
Yeah. That's a very important argument that's central to, you know, the book, and I have to give credit where it's due, because of the original formulator of that, you know, or the theorization of that was in Kenyan novelist and drama playwright Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. And he wrote a book called Pen Points, Gun Points, and Dreams in 1998, which was in the course of my my research. I discovered it, and it perfectly described the events that were happening. So I thought, all right, this is really important for people to grasp about this, because the common view, and this was shared by many of the participants as well, was that, well, you know, it's political lyrics or the title of a song or the intentions of the artist that determines whether or not music is political or not. And to a large extent, one could say, okay, there were a lot of actually radical or political songs. So what's Matt talking about when he says all music was? And precisely, the relationship between the actual structures of music itself, meaning things that I mentioned before, song formats, mixture of styles, all these things, challenged the music industry, which, as I contend, and I believe I prove, is an arm of the state. It's not an independent business, as if independent businesses in the United States, whether they be General Motors or Bank of America or RCA Victor, are independent. They control the state, or the state controls them. They are one and the same. And by that, I mean the sanctions that were given by the United States government for copyright and patent is what enabled the music industry to function as it does. Without those laws made in 1909 and 1917, respectively, we wouldn't have a music industry in the same way. And in return for those sanctions, the music industry has, by and large, done the bidding of its masters. And so his master's voice is who? Who's the master? And his master's voice has been saying, this is what music is supposed to do. It's supposed to, you know, entertain people. It's supposed to make people, essentially obedient workers and consumers. And so, on the other hand, as soon as music challenges that, as soon as music starts to break out of that, it becomes avant-garde art or some marginal thing. It may not actually be suppressed as it has been in other places, but it gets marginalized to the point where no one is going to, you know, it's harmless. But as soon as it becomes something that young people in particular, but broadly in society, start taking up as their own and use it to express their own desires, their own demands for liberation, then it becomes a real rival of the state. And this took many forms. And it's, in this sense, not unique to the 60s. And that is that everything from clothing styles, hairstyles, sexual mores, attitudes towards what is authentic and what is not, what is authority and what is not, who are you going to listen to decide what you think is right and wrong? This is what music was legislating on. And, you know, people adopted music as an identifier of their rebellious spirit and their desire to be free. And those things are incontestable. No one would deny that. And I think the confusion has come. And this is certainly the case in many of the people I interviewed who were musicians active at the time, was that they still essentially accepted this role of music being accompaniment, that meaning music is the accompaniment for poetry, and the poetry expresses the intention of the music. And now, certainly, we have a vast legacy of revolutionary songs, including all the ones that you just mentioned from Joe Hill and many other people, and that's true actually throughout the world. Cultures throughout the world have produced songs that represent the people's struggle to be free. That's a wonderful thing. I don't want to say that that's somehow been superseded by the 60s. But in the 60s, along with things that were overt, you know, Phil Oakes songs or Buffy St. Marie's songs or songs that were actually explicitly political, their music itself became so closely identified with the struggles of black people on the one hand, the civil rights movement, and with the anti-war movement and later the farm workers movement and various other things, that it was this a unifying glue. So a good example would be Creedence Clearwater and their the fact that they became a symbol, in a sense, for GI resistance in the Army. You know, that was one of the bands, came out of the Bay Area, playing what I would call working-class music, actually. At the time, it was just swamp rock. But it has as much folk and country elements as anything. But it's just the spirit that it conveyed and the feeling that it evoked was a bond of solidarity amongst GIs. And this is, you know, again, I quote numerous soldiers talking about the role that music played in their resistance within the armed service. And this is the perfect example. It was not a specific song or a specific lyric. You know, it was just the idea of black and white GIs, Chicano GIs, Native American GIs, whatever, all being thrown together in this horrible situation and trying to find some way across these racial divides. And music was one of the ways that they could link up.
You also say that the future is irrepressible and a province of the mind, and that art itself is a kind of fight for the future, the ability to determine what happens, and it's a part of the struggle for liberation. And I think that really speaks to what you were just saying. But let's talk for a moment about this concept of the future. It's very important because it's the realm of imagining a new world, right?
Right.
And it's a place that, as you say so eloquently elsewhere in the book, you know, capitalists can't buy it, armies can't defeat it, and it's a province for creating a new world.
Well, obviously art has always, I would say, from the first flute or the first cave painting or wherever it begins, has been an expression of some kind of imaginative power within human consciousness and its ability to bring people together and to form community and strengthen the bonds that make humans human. That's no one would deny that, and there's no question about that role. However, In the particular context of our society today, and you know, in that sense, I'm including the 60s in the present, you know, the you might say modern times. In this context, that one of the things that art has certainly done, and this is by no means limited to music, has been to envision a society different than, better than, beyond the present. Now, whether you are an anti-capitalist or not, I mean, I call it capitalism, you can call it the system, you can call it totalitarianism, whatever name you want it, but it's bad. And we want to change it, and we want it to be better. And in many cases, It is the artist who actually has to provide some sense, some kind of vision or picture, if you want to use that word, or sound or emotion that fills out an image that becomes real in the present because you're experiencing it now. But it is of the future. And that projection is absolutely crucial. As I say in the last chapter of the book, I think it was one of the lessons, a negative lesson of the 60s, that it was a, you might say, a failing of the political left, and I use that term very broadly, that political theorists, political leaders were very capable of articulating what they did not want, what the future would not be, but not very good at articulating what it would be. And so that was in many ways left to the artist to do. And I think that's a failing because while it's, you might say, almost natural for artists to do that and inspire feelings of joy and inspiration to challenge the status quo to bring a new world into being, there still have to be articulations of how you're going to feed, clothe, shelter, educate, and take care of people and concrete ways to make liberation, something that people actually want and will enjoy.
Yeah, I was just thinking while you were talking, I'm like, yes, I enjoy reading the pointy heads, but the pointy heads aren't so good at actually getting down and doing the hard work of figuring out how this system's going to, operate in a different way. And I think that's a critique that many people have of, well, you seem to know a lot about how the system and the empire works, but how is it going to work in the future? And usually the answer is, well, it would be almost authoritarian to suggest I know the answer to what it's going to look like in the future.
Right.
And I'm like, well, can we try a few things?
Right. Exactly. Well, in fact, I think I'm glad you mentioned that because I do think that there are a lot of people now trying to learn that lesson. And I don't want to make it sound like, it's that lesson is, completely lost or whatever. But I do think actually it is a challenge and a task that's really pressing now. No matter how dark the times get, and they certainly are dark at the moment, you surrender way too much and way too easily if you do not continually think about the future and how it can actually inform and inspire the present. This is extremely important, and I think that, there are a lot of factors involved with why the revolution of the 60s was defeated, and it suffered a defeat, and this is not the only one, but this is pretty crucial in terms of my thesis because it's the intersection of art and politics, and this is something where I think we have to do a lot better in the future, in the near future, in the present. We have to do a lot better of integrating art and politics so that they can infuse each other with the same kind of power that they had back then.
You write, it bears repeating that the great majority of musicians at the time were not revolutionaries or even politically active, but music was. So I want to talk a little bit about this relationship between radical movements like the Panthers, the anti-Vietnam War movement, feminism, etc., and music. How did music interact with social movements? Or maybe a better question is, how was music interwoven into social movements? And maybe there was some kind of dialectic of resistance.
Mm-hmm. I think first of all, the ways are there's a vast number of ways. So what I'm going to try to do is give a description of how, some of the best examples of how this all worked together might be, let's just take the broad genre of jazz. The fact that at that time jazz was enjoying a renaissance just as great as, other popular forms of music and was just as influential is very important because that's been sort of written out of history too, by the rock revolution. But when you look at the vast number of works that were produced by the leading artists of the day, and in some cases the titles of the songs do say that the intention was revolutionary. Attica Blues by Archie Shepp, the Charlie Hayden, Carla Bley, Liberation Music Orchestra, Songs for Che, and so on and so forth. Some of them were explicit in that sense. But more importantly, the experimentation and the broadening out of music's influence in the context of the black liberation struggle, inspired by the black liberation struggle on the one side, but in turn inspiring that struggle and saying the most advanced, innovative, interesting, creative, inspiring music is being made by people involved with this struggle. This was an incredibly powerful example. And certainly, you know, there were, again, songs being written by numerous artists. Of course, the famous ones are people like John Lennon or whatever, who, you know, wrote explicitly political songs, Power to the People and whatnot. But that's in some ways only in a way a reflection of what was happening on a much broader level, a much deeper level. And by that I mean the sympathy or the spirit, if you want to say, that's embodied in, say, Country Joe's Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag, things like that. Okay, this was how an entire generation felt. So you didn't necessarily have to know all the words or, you know, you certainly got the joke, but, you know, you certainly understood what this was about and what this sort of funny parodic song, which had no relation to rock and roll at all, coming from, you know, a band like Country Joe, would somehow just sort of transcend all the different musical boundaries, and there it is. The same could be said about Santana, you know, playing a largely instrumental music. I mean, actually, you know, they had songs, but in fact, some of their greatest stuff was instrumental music at a time when, you know, rock bands always had to have a singer, you know. But Incident at Nishapur, which was written with a revolutionary musician, Alberto Gianquinto and Carlos Santana, is celebrating a battle in the Haitian Revolution. And I mean, things like that were widespread and were amongst the most popular things of the time. And so what's lost in hindsight is it's sort of like, yes, that was famous, or that was a hit, or that was a, you know, which then leaps to assume that means it was co-opted or something. But at the time, no. This was just massively popular because there was a mass movement involved. And this is another thing I have to emphasize, is that it's important to keep in mind that a mass movement is a qualitative thing as well as a quantitative thing. It's not just how many people were in the streets. It's the fact that everyone was being influenced by that movement. There was no way to avoid it, regardless of your position on the Vietnam War or, you know, marijuana or whatever else. You were going to be influenced by the movement.
What was the role of rock music journalism? Outfits like Rolling Stone. I mean, was this just a vehicle for hip capitalism? Were they sort of an establishment force trying to direct this sort of revolutionary moment?
In terms of historical fact, rock music journalism was born in the 60s, and it really originates there. There was no such thing beforehand. I mean, there were, you know, popular music critics, there were jazz critics and stuff like that, but there was no rock music journalism as we know it today. In fact, it was more or less founded, not entirely, but certainly symbolically, by Rolling Stone magazine in San Francisco in 1967. From the outset, it was a contentious operation. One of its founders, Ralph Gleason, obviously had a different idea in mind than Jan Wenner, and they fought acrimoniously over that to the point where Gleason had to get out and sell his shares because he saw the direction it was going. And I would say, generally speaking, the role, and of course I'm not speaking of every rock critic or every music critic by any means, I have to make that clear, but that particular publication, Rolling Stone, and what it represents was a deliberate and conscious effort to divert the rebellious, or, you know, you might say, revolutionary edge of the music in general into a safe channel for the Democratic Party. It was to actually bring people into line with what, you know, they accomplished it by 1976 with Jimmy Carter's election, where he used rock and roll for the first time. First president to use rock bands and rock music for his campaign. And of course, it's gone on since then. I mean, the whole imagery that's associated with the quote rock revolution terminology, the again, there's lots of substantiating quotes in the book that come directly from Jan Wenner or directly from Rolling Stone magazine, which make clear what their intentions were. I'm not making this up. It's not a matter of interpretation. It's what they said about themselves. And that really was to say, you know, all this political stuff is really not that important. What's really important is the energy. whatever that means, or people really want to just have fun, or it's an expression of teenage angst or whatever. I mean, there's a number of different phrases that have they've entered common parlance because they've been used so often to describe something that actually was an element of what was happening but did not characterize it.
Well, you know, just read recently that Bruce Springsteen, President Obama, Oprah were on some yacht out in the Philippines, you know, this mm-hmm. sort of merging of power and the symbol, alleged symbol of rebellious music.
Mm-hmm.
And it was David Geffen's yacht, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That would make sense.
Sadly, it does. Okay. So what is this trope about the good 60s versus the bad 60s?
Well, that's not something I invented. I discovered it, actually, in the course of research, you know, reading what ended up being about 300 books on the subject. I just noticed that it was very common. It appeared in dozens and dozens of books. I'm talking about history now, not specifically music related. And the classic is The 60s by Todd Gitlin, where he really does make that distinction, you know. And essentially, it's from 64, depending on where you want to say it started, 1960 even, with the first sit-ins in North Carolina, you know, the first young African-American students sitting in at Woolworth's, that sort of marks the beginning of the 60s. Or you could say 65 and so on. It doesn't really matter where it begins, but it definitely ends in 1969. And it's not just because the number of the decades, but it's the one of the ways of characterizing it is that Woodstock was the apex and Altamont was the nadir, and from that point on you had Charles Manson and the death of the whole hippie dream and all that stuff. But it goes even beyond that to characterizing the political new left as being essentially a nonviolent, although disruptive, movement to, you know, armed revolution, destructions, bombing, and essentially self-destruction at the same time. And this is false on a number of levels. In other words, things did not end in 69. In fact, you know, as I make clear in the book, musically they didn't end because you have, in San Francisco in particular, you have the birth of some of the greatest music of the period: Sly and the Family Stone, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Tower of Power, Santana, and on, who just began making great records at that time. And secondly, in terms of political terms, just the women's liberation movement on the one hand, and GI resistance on the other, all of them pushed the 60s past that point and made enormous changes in society. And anyone who's serious about like what actually happened in terms of changing popular consciousness and actually the conditions in which we live, to overlook the role of women's liberation, which really took off in 1970, this is, you know, you have to say, okay, this is somebody with an agenda. This is somebody who's writing history to make it correspond to what they want as opposed to what actually happened. And that's where I was trying to overcome this sort of good 60s, bad 60s.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, of course, there's a lot of books written about the sort of the battle for the story of the 60s, you know, the spitting
right.
image about the alleged spitting on soldiers by
right.
the movement, which
yes.
never happened.
Right.
Of course, there was the, as you say, the explosion of the women's liberation movement, the ecological movement.
Right.
And later on, we see the beginnings of the anti-nuclear movement. There's so many. We've got about 4 minutes left, and I want to ask you about this period and why it was capped at 1975. Maybe just comment on the end of the war in Vietnam, COINTELPRO, what was the movement's limitations? I know there's a lot of questions here, but just pick up on any thread. And, you know, the co-optation of music by corporation and the beginning of punk and, you know, the idea that punk's declaring we had no future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that kind of says it all right there. And as far as the dating, and as I say early on in the book, I mean, the dates are somewhat arbitrary and you could argue various different reasons for starting and ending in a certain place. And that really wasn't my point, but my point was to call attention to key events such as the final withdrawal of all U.S. presence in Vietnam. That took place in 1975. And in terms of music, It was the end of Sly and the Family Stone, who played a very important role, and their final album and their final tour had Bob Marley and the Wailers opening, or it was actually just the Wailers at the time. And so you could sort of see a torch being passed. And then, of course, 1976, you know, No Future, God Save the Queen. I mean, this is London taking it on, and not only taking it on, but making a critique of San Francisco in the 60s, deliberately, overtly. No long hair, no long guitar solos, no long songs, and none of this peace and love stuff, which, you know, from that point of view, was just, you know, a nonsense dream that was used to delude people, as opposed to an ideal. You know, ideal. If you listen to the lyrics of Hate and War by The Clash, you realize that they're not celebrating hate and war. They're certainly, but they are criticizing peace and love deliberately. Obviously, the title says it, by saying this is the reality. Face it, you know. And I think that that's again why I drew the line at 75. That's why I think that this question of Children of the Future, which is the second chapter of the book and the title of an album by album and song by Steve Miller in 1968, becomes No Future in 1976. And again, these are, you could say, symbolic. But they do, they symbolize something very real, and they're important markers of what had happened. And again, with so little time, I'm, you know, can't get into all the reasons for defeat and setback and so on and so forth. But it's, I do want to add that the ska, punk, reggae ethos that developed in London, Jamaica, and other places at that time were characterized by an attempt to, you know, carry on, you might say, the radical traditions of the 60s while making a critique. And they did so by, you know, having these big festivals like Rock Against Racism in London and so on, and the whole movement of trying to merge black and white artists, musicians, and so on and so forth, as opposed to segregate them. And so it's very clear to me from that that if you look at the 60s through those lenses and how those outgrowths, then you see what you, not only that there was a defeat, but on the other hand, that there was an attempt to carry it forward. People did try to keep it going, which is why it's been so contested whether or not it ended. When did the 60s end? Which, you know, is kind of like how the final chapter of my book ends, is with that kind of discussion, because, I mean, it's very important to recognize both the strengths and the weakness of the period, what we can learn from that is positive, as well as what we have to learn from that was negative.
Hmm. Matt, how would people get this book? And if they wanted to contact you, do you have a website?
Yeah, mattcallahan.com. That's Matt with it, one T, mattcallahan.com. PM Press has a website, pmpress.org. You can get it through them. It's at a number of bookstores, including Skylight Books here in L.A. And I think, you know, of course, you can always find it online. Just look for The Explosion of Deferred Dreams.
The Explosion of Deferred Dreams, Musical Renaissance and Social Revolution in San Francisco, 1965 to 1975. Matt, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity.
For more information on Matt's book, please visit pmpress.org. or mattcallahan.com. That's Matt with one T. This is Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett. If you have any comments or questions, please email Chris at indymedia.org. That's Chris at indymedia.org. And please visit and post at la.indymedia.org. Thanks for listening.